All right, let's get into chapter 12. I mean, 15, Isaiah 15. All right. Okay, what was unique about 14 from last week? What was unique? What was the big thing that you should remember from chapter 14? What is the giant issue thing that you should remember from chapter 14? Somebody.
The sons of God are fallen angels.
Yeah, that's kind of where we ended up. Yeah, that's for sure. It was quite the digression. What dualistic prophecy is in, or description or narrative is in Isaiah 14? We see this king of Babylon who is probably also whom?
Satan.
All right, so that's what I want you to remember. That's, you need to be thinking, you need to make a note for yourself that Isaiah 14 has a prophetic or a narrative description of what we believe is the fall of Satan, okay? But it also has a localized prophecy, and that's concerning the actual king of Babylon. What's the language in Isaiah 14? So do we briefly review? What's the language that we know lets us know it can't be a king alone? What's the language in 14 that definitively says to us, this just can't be a human king?
Verse 12.
All right. Blake says verse 12. Read it.
How you have fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn. You've been cut down to earth. You have weakened, you who have weakened the nations.
Yep. Okay. Any other language in there that would say similar kind of stuff as you look at that?
Verse 13.
Okay. 13 as well. Yep. So why do we think this has a localized, contextual fulfillment as well? Do you have a heading in front of verse 3?
Yeah.
What's it say?
Israel's remnant taunts Babylon.
Okay, right. So Babylon at that point, is that a real place?
Yes.
Yes. With a particular ethnicity and the whole works?
And a king.
And a king, right. So that's why we think absolutely it has a localized fulfillment at that time frame. How many years do we think Isaiah is before Jesus, approximately?
600 to 700,
right. Somewhere around there. Okay, somewhere around there. What was our order of nations? Who can remember? Chris, you can remember our order of nations taking us up to Christ. We know that in the days of Christ, who's in charge?
Romans.
The Romans are. So let's just kind of remind ourselves. Let's do a backwards, listing. So the Romans are in charge in Matthew 1. And then the intertestament period. What's the intertestament period?
Greeks.
Right, the Greeks are in charge. And what do we mean by the intertestament period?
From the end of Malachi until the beginning of the New Testament.
That's right. Yeah, and you're right, James. It's about 400 years from Malachi 4 to Matthew 1. All right, Chris, who is before the Greeks?
Persians.
The Persians, right.
Medo-Persians,
all right. All right, and then before the Persians?
Babylonians.
The Babylonians. That's not how you spell it, okay? Right. You just do it like this, and then you put SP, and that's like, that allows you to do whatever you want.
Okay. Is that what you tell to your ninth graders?
Right. They have access to Google, okay? I'm choosing not to go look it up. Right. And then, who's here?
Assyrians.
Assyrians, right. Assyrians, okay? All right. And the Assyrians are the nation that conquers who? That we're concerned.
Israel and kingdom.
Yeah, Israel, right. And what year is that they do that?
722.
Yep, 722. And if we put a big 10 right here, why are we putting a 10 there?
Ten tribes.
Yeah, the 10 tribes. Right, the 10 tribes. And we're going to see a little bit of this on Sunday for just a moment because, you know, God marries Israel. Takes him as his bride. God does. Yahweh does. And then it splits into two nations and he ends up having two wives, Israel and Judah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And they force that upon God through their rebellion, the separation of nations. And then Israel gets conquered in 722 BC. And then when did the Babylonians get conquered? 586. That's right. 586. And then you've got a 70-year period of what? 70 years of what? What do we call that? Yeah, of captivity.
Yeah.
Yeah, and who's our major players during that captivity?
Daniel.
Daniel's definitely one of them. Who was our other one from last, when we were in that room?
Ezekiel.
Ezekiel, right. Ezekiel was our major player that time. Okay? And then 516, what happens?
Zerubbabel.
Right. Zerubbabel leads what?
The Jews.
The Jews, an element of the Jews, to go back to where?
Jerusalem.
To Jerusalem. And what do they set about doing?
Rebuilding the temple.
Yeah, they've got to rebuild the temple. Right. And you'll hear this described as Second Temple Judaism. Historians will call this Second Temple Judaism. Okay? Because of its difference. And then after Zerubbabel is who?
Ezra.
Ezra. Right? And after Ezra is
Nehemiah.
Right. Okay. And these three are responsible for leading delegations back to Jerusalem for this rebuilding that takes place. As a side note concerning this temple, what are the two things you should know about this from the younger generation and the older generation? What are the two things you should know?
Not as beautiful as the first one.
Right, so for the older folks, so the James Batiste in the room, and the folks who have been married for 48 years, they look at the temple, and what are they doing, Jan?
They're crying.
They're weeping.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're weeping. Why are they weeping? Who can remember why they're weeping? Quinn, why are they weeping?
Not as beautiful in comparison.
Yeah, it's pitiful. What were they comparing it to?
Solomon's
temple. Yeah. That's right. They're comparing it to Solomon's temple. And then what are the young people, Drew's age and Sydney's age, Nate's age, what are they? What are they?
They're thrilled that they've got a temple.
That's right. Because they've been living in Babylon, and they haven't had a temple. They're like Daniel. They've looked towards Jerusalem and know that's the direction they're supposed to pray, but they've not had a temple. Now they have their own temple. And by the time you get to Nehemiah's days, they also have what now?
Walls.
They have walls. Yeah, so it really feels like this incredible rebuilding time. And so... We're here with the Babylonians.
Isaiah's actually in the 700s.
Yes.
Right? He's talking about the Babylonians, but he's prophesying way in advance of.
Well, the Babylonians are an entity alive, but they're not a superpower, right, at this point. But they're an entity that needs to be dealt with. Okay.
But the Assyrians are still in power at that time, right?
Yes, they would be the dominant power. But you can see in verse 24, concerning of chapter 14, the Lord of the armies has sworn, as I have purposed, so it will be. I have planned it, so it will happen. I will break Assyria in my land. I will tread him down on my mountain. And so we have this promise of the destruction of them. So Blake, why don't you start reading chapter 15?
The oracle concerning Moab. Surely in a night, Ar of Moab is devastated and ruined. Surely in a night, Kir of Moab is devastated and ruined. They have gone up to the temple and to Dibon, even to the highest places to weep. Moab wells over Nebo and Medeba. Everyone's head is bald and every beard is cut off. Verse 3. In their streets they have girded themselves with sackcloth, on their housetops and in their squares. Everyone is wailing, dissolved in tears. Heshbon and Eliah also cry out. Their voice is heard all the way to Jahaz. Therefore, the armed men of Moab cry aloud. His soul trembles within him. Verse 5. My heart cries out for Moab. His fugitives are as far as Zoar and Eglath-Shelishiah, for they go up the ascent of Lehith weeping. Surely on the road to Horonam, they raise a cry of distress over their ruin. Verse 6. For the waters of Nimrim are desolate. Surely the grass is withered, the tender grass died out. There is no green thing. Therefore, the abundance which they have acquired and stored up, they carry off over the brook of Aradon. Verse 8. For the cry of distress has gone out. The territory of Moab, it wails its wail goes as far as Elgin, and its wailing even to Beer-Elim. Verse 9. For the waters of Dimon are full of blood. Surely I will bring added woes upon Dimon, a lion upon the fugitives of Moab, and upon the remnant of the land.
Well, you did a good job with that. Yeah.
Tongue twisters.
Pronunciation was difficult. All right, tell me what we know about the Moabites. Tell me what we know about the Moabites. Let's get some background to the Moabites. Go, Sean.
They come from the descendants of Lot, the two sons that he had from his
daughters.
No, I'm saying,
from the daughters.
So it was Ammon, Ben-Ammon, and Moab.
Okay, where do we know this from?
Genesis.
Yep, where in Genesis?
19.
Yeah, that's what she said.
Yeah.
14.
13. Yeah, nicely done. So let's go back to Genesis 19 for a minute to remind ourselves about the Moabites. Let's go back to 19, at the end of 19. Okay, Chris, start with verse 30.
And Lot went up out of Zoar and dwelt in the mountains, and his two daughters with him, for he feared to dwell in Zoar, and he dwelt in a cave, he and his two daughters. And the firstborn said unto the younger, Our father is old, and there is not a man in the earth to come in unto us after the manner of all the earth. Verse 32. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and we will lie with him, that we may preserve seed of our father. And they made their father drink wine that night, and the firstborn went in and lay with her father, and he perceived not when she lay down, nor when she arose. And it came to pass on the morrow that the firstborn said unto the younger, Behold, I lay yesternight with my father. Let us make him drink wine this night also, and go thou in, and lie with him, that we may preserve seed of our father. And they made their father drink wine that night also, and the younger arose, and lay with him, and he perceived not when she lay down, nor when she arose. Thus were both the daughters of Lot with child by their father. And the firstborn bare a son, and called his name Moab. The same is the father of the Moabites unto this day. And the younger, she also bare a son, and called his name Ben-Ammon, the same as the father of the children of Ammon unto this day.
Okay, why do we care about this?
Because of the sin came out of it.
Sure. What else?
The Ammonites and Moabites were foreign to Israelis and the Israelite side throughout the entire process of them coming into.
Yep.
Yeah.
Right.
Sorry, what did you say? Can you say that louder?
Yeah, sorry. The Moabites and the Ammonites were like a thorn in the side of the Israelites as they came into the land. Yeah,
as they were traveling from en route to the Promised Land. Yeah.
And somewhat to even this day, Ammon is the capital of Jordan, the area where the Ammonites were. Nebo, which is mentioned in here, is Mount, well, it could be associated with Mount Nebo. It also means prophet, and it was also a Babylonian god. But it's in that area of Moab as well, which is southern, like not southern, but it's Edom, like in between. They were, even to this day, they're a problem.
Right. And what is Lot's relationship, Josh? What's Lot's relationship to all this thing?
Well, Lot is the nephew of Abraham.
Right, he's the nephew of Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
So, what God should he be worshiping?
Yahweh.
Yeah, he should be worshiping Yahweh. Yeah, and instead of worshiping Yahweh, what's he to choose to do? Go live where?
Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah, Sodom and Gomorrah. And it's a disaster at this point. So, here we are. How would you summarize chapter 15? We just read chapter 15. Lake did a great job. How would you summarize it?
Future prophecy against the Moabites fulfilled by Nebuchadnezzar after he destroys Jerusalem.
Okay. And is there any language in that prophecy that you guys want to talk about? Anything jump off the page of you? Is that to those nine verses?
Moab is laid waste in a night. Moab is undone. So it's going to happen quickly.
Yep. What else?
Verses 2 and 3. They went up to the temple and worshiped their gods. And God pretty much says, those are your gods that you're praying to, not me. So you're on your own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, this is Israel in its adulterous state, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Who else? Anything else in there that you wanted to take a look at?
We talked about Moab, but out of Moab came Ruth, great grandmother of David, which means that a Gentile is in the bloodline of Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah, and not just one, right?
Yeah.
Three, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
So I would also say, it's mentioned in verse 2, Madaba is actually a Christian enclave in Jordan today. It's a Christian city.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, it's not exclusively Christian, but it's like 80% Christian.
In a world of Muslims.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how that relates to this, but it's just an interesting fact about the city.
All right, anybody else in here? Anybody see something here that you didn't understand? Because it's poetic. Prophetic language. Poetic, prophetic language of a coming destruction. Judgment. What is the significance of Isaiah prophesying about it?
That it's being revealed to him.
Yep.
The special revelation.
All right, what else?
What's also being told to the Jews that, you know, your enemies are going to be destroyed.
Yeah. Anything else?
Moab should have never been this area.
Okay, why do you say that, Jack?
Because Lot was supposed to have never been in that area. When Abraham was called, he was called to leave his father's house, and he took Lot with him, which he should never have done in the original calling out of Genesis 12.
I hadn't thought about that before, Jack.
He was supposed to separate completely from his father's house, and he didn't.
Because of bringing that nephew with him.
Because of bringing the nephew with him. And then it was, and that's what created the first conflict that caused him to separate from his nephew and everything else. But the love of his father's home kept drawing him back and keeping him embroiled in the conflicts of the region. And God used that love, though, to teach us about how intercession of prayer.
But it also is interesting because in Genesis 12, Lot goes off to Sodom and Gomorrah, and it almost seems, that's when Abraham goes to save him through that amazing war journey that he goes on. And then that's whenever he believes God after he went up there with only like 300 people to save Lot. And that's whenever he's given his righteousness.
And isn't Lot considered righteous in Hebrews? Hold up.
Peter, right? Is it Peter that refers to righteous Lot?
Vexing his soul.
Yeah. Is it Peter?
Yeah.
Come on, somebody knows.
I know he's considered righteous.
No, you're exactly right. Is it James or is it Peter?
Second Peter, I pass him.
Where? Where?
Second Peter. Second Peter, chapter 2, verse 7.
All right, let's go there. Swords or else. See who gets there first.
Who's there?
Digital doesn't count. All right, nice, man.
I'm here. Yes.
You have paper?
Yes.
Okay. Are the cats going to be okay?
Well, just one.
Okay. All right.
And if he rescued righteous Lot, oppressed by the sensual conduct of unprincipled men,
one more time.
And if he rescued righteous Lot, oppressed by the sensual conduct of unprincipled men.
Yeah, so why is he being called righteous? What did Abraham intercede? What was the dialogue between Abraham and God? Come on, somebody who never talks. You know this story. What is the interaction?
There's one.
Yeah. He goes back and forth. What's he start with? Who remembers what number they start with?
50.
Right, some crazy number, right? And then Abraham goes, I don't think I'm going to be able to Google 50 righteous people in this city. So what happens? Yeah, they start walking the numbers down, right? Yeah, and then God shows himself to be amazing because although he does destroy the city, he sends in the angels to rescue righteous Lot. But he doesn't seem very righteous to our perspective, does he? So what do we make of that?
Well, maybe just the fact that it's absolutely horrible what he's trying to do, offering his own daughters to rescue the strangers.
Okay.
Disgusting.
But what? You don't finish your thought, Georgianne.
Well, I just can't overcome that, but maybe that he was willing to sacrifice something in order to rescue someone else for the sake of someone else. Because I'm guessing he loved his daughters and he was willing to sacrifice them for the sake of these guests.
So is it him extending hospitality to these strangers?
I'm still
struggling with it, right? Like,
I think if you look at the story that we're talking about with Lot and then Isaiah 14, or I'm sorry, 15, and then what Dr. Farmer said, you kind of see this truth that even righteous people commit offenses that have consequences that last through generations.
Sure. Another example of that would be David, right?
Yes. Yeah. And even in our own lives, what are we doing that can affect our future children?
Sure.
Yeah. But what, was Lot considered righteous because he was spared? No, I don't know.
Because he spared the guests, right?
Well, the second verse to that in 2 Peter 8 is for that righteous man, talking about Lot, dwelling among them, tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds.
Wow.
Wasn't Lot raised by Abraham?
I would say.
So then he would have grown up knowing Yahweh.
Sure.
So he would have been experiencing like very different things and he would have known.
Perhaps.
So you're saying he probably had faith in Yahweh and that's what's even?
I don't know. I'm just thinking like compared to the others, he would probably have a more righteous standard than the rest of them in his heart. I don't know about his actions.
I should have been a witness. I mean, there's only one in there. They need to say something about him being at the gate, so it's sort of a position of
sure.
authority, too. You know?
He does say that he's at the gate. What do you got, James?
Well, my footnote here says he was a righteous man in that he believed God and was vexed at the licentiousness of the wicked people about him. So his life was lived for himself.
So that vexing the soul stuff. Sean, did you read that note? Is that what you did?
No, I did not. I was just going right up through there.
Yeah.
Oh, Pastor Sean.
Yes.
So in verse 9, it says that...
verse 9 of what? Back in Isaiah?
No, 2 Peter.
Okay, that's right.
It says, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptation and to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment.
Yeah, and then it turns out starts talking about angels, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it seems that he knew that Lot was righteous, and like you said, he put in the side note about Lot was tormented from being swayed from his righteousness and so on, but he knew from that argument from Abraham that I'll save the righteous even if they're in the midst of temptation and wickedness.
Okay, how do we get on this again? Who can remind? How do we get here? How do we get here?
Moab.
By way of Moab, right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Anybody else in chapter 15?
I find one thing that's interesting. Verse 5,
yep.
15, mine. He's saying, my heart will cry out from Moab. I do have a note in here that says that this is Isaiah talking, like in a way that I guess. Like feeling some sort of sympathy towards Moab from the struggles that they're dealing with. I don't know if that's accurate. I'm just
is it a commentator?
Yeah, it is.
But how does he know that my heart is Moab's? I mean, is Isaiah's...
I don't think he does, but the way I got there was that as I read it, I was like, I saw the my heart will cry out from Moab, and I was like, whose heart?
Well, there's quotation marks, so I wonder if it's God saying that.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Like, I'm trying to figure out who...
But you understand, when you just said that, right, that you have no Hebrew support for that. There are no quotation marks in the Hebrew.
Yeah.
Mm.
No.
No, there aren't any.
Yeah, they don't need any.
Right, We as students of the Bible have to be able to distinguish between when our translators are providing clarity for us based on their opinion. We see that with uppercase letters. Okay, we see that with quotation marks. The natural things that we assume our English language has, we superimpose on the Hebrew language, and the text doesn't let us do that. Does everyone understand what I mean by that? That's why we're struggling with understanding. Is this Yahweh saying that his heart is crying over Moab?
Yes. So if you go to Jeremiah 48, verse 31.
All right, hold on. Give us a chance to get that.
Nice.
Jeremiah 48 what?
Starting verse 31. All the way to 35.
There, man. Jesus. Yeah, let's read it.
It starts with saying, therefore I wail over Moab, for all Moab I cry out. I moan for the people of Kir Hareset. I weep for you as Jazer weeps. There, you vines of Simba. I wonder if that is Simba. Your branches spread as far as the sea. They reach as far as Jazer. The destroyer has fallen on your ripened fruits and grapes. Joy and gladness are gone from the orchards and fields of Moab. I have stopped the flow of wine from the presses. No one treads them without shouts of joy. Although there are shouts there, they are not shouts of joy. The sound of their cry rises from Heshbon to Lil and Jahaz, from Zor as far as Horonaim and Elgeth Shalishia. For even the waters of Nimrim are dried up. In Moab, I will put an end to those who make offerings on the high places and burn incense to their gods, declares the Lord.
Yeah, okay. This is Yahweh's declaration. So you're right. So that seems to nail it down pretty sufficiently.
Good find.
That this is Yahweh. This is Yahweh screaming out that his heart cries over Moab. All right, why do we care about that? Why do we care about the fact that Yahweh is crying over Moab?
Because he says that he... which is a number, or that none should perish.
Yeah.
I'm not quoting it perfectly, but that's
true. He takes no pleasure in punishing those who are punished.
But he's also just.
Yeah.
So I love the fact that he's crying over Moab, because I'm a lot closer to Moab than I am any Jew.
Yeah, they were a Gentile.
Right. Yep. Good job. Anything else in this chapter?
Can I make an aside?
Sure.
When we were in Israel.
Oh, here it
comes. I know.
The eliteness of when I was in Israel.
No. But this was really cool.
Yeah.
We were able to see where Abraham and Lot separated. Okay, so we're standing and they were viewing. You know, we know the story of Abraham said, I'll let you pick your area. And Lot picked the area down along the Jordan River, which would have been lush and green and beautiful. And according to Dr. Bookman, our guide, the Jordan River went all the way to the Gulf of Aqaba at that point. It didn't stop at the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea didn't exist. And it, when Sodom and Gomorrah, when God rained fire and brimstone on Sodom and Gomorrah, that's what dammed up the Jordan River and created the Dead Sea.
Hmm.
So.
Now, I don't mean to be a scoffer here, but how do they know that that's where Abraham and... I mean, that's like me taking you to Tennessee and going, this is where David Crockett was when... is it David Crockett that went to...
There's a plaque in our Tennessee.
Oh, there's a plaque.
After he got voted out, he told everybody to go to, you know where, he was going to Texas.
Yeah.
In our county courthouse. When he got married, so...
Well, according to the Bible, it was between two cities, and those two cities still exist.
Okay.
And so, and those two cities are only like a mile apart. And so this area is literally right between these two cities. And there is significant
archaeological finds that date way back to say this would have been the area that would have been venerated, I guess, by, you know, the early Christians and,
okay,
and before. So
right,
multiple, there was, you know, Byzantine church, and then there was the, what's we call it, church, the Crusader church, and et cetera, all built in that area.
Nice.
So.
Okay. Anybody else in the room been to Israel? No. Nice. Yeah. You put your hand up.
But you do.
That's good. All right, anybody else? And we get into chapter 16. We only have 66 chapters, so we want to get down in the weeds when we need to and keep the high view when we need to. Lynn, did you bring a Bible that you can read this week?
I've gotten the King James. King James here.
Yeah, we'll hear from that. Yeah.
So where are we at?
We like the King's 16. English.
16.
First one of 16. Yes.
Okay.
I doest. Yep.
Yes. He said New King James.
Yes, tomorrow.
Yes.
Yes, tomorrow.
Okay, chapter 16, verse 1. Send the lamb to the ruler of the land, from Selah to the wilderness, to the mount of the daughter of Zion, where it shall be as a wandering bird thrown out of the nest, so shall be the daughters of Moab at the fords of the Arnon. Verse 3. Take counsel, execute judgment, make your shadow like the night in the middle of the day. Hide the outcast, do not betray them who escapes. Verse 4. Let my outcast dwell with you, O Moab. Be a shelter to them from the face of the spoiler, for the extortioner is at an end. Devastation ceases, the oppressors are consumed out of the land. In mercy, the throne will be established, and one will sit on it in truth in the tabernacle of David, judging and seeking justice and hasting righteousness. We have heard of the pride of Moab. He is very proud. Oh, his haughtiness and his pride and his wrath, but he lies, but his lies shall not be so. Therefore Moab shall wail for Moab. Everyone will wail, shall wail. For the foundation of Kir, Hareseth, you shall mourn. Surely they are stricken. Verse 8. For the fields of the Heshbon languish, and the vine of Sema, and the vine of Sema. The lords of the nations have broken down its choice plants, which have reached to Jazer, and wandered through the wilderness. Her branches are stretched out, they are gone over the sea. Therefore I will bewail the vine of Sema, and with weeping of Jazer, I will drench you with my tears, O Heshbon and Eliah. For battle cries have fallen over your summer fruits and your harvest. Verse 10. Gladness is taken away, and joy from the plentiful field. In the vineyards there will be no singing, nor will there be shouting. No treaders will tread out wine in the presses. I have made their shouting cease. Therefore my heart shall resound like the harp of Moab, and my inner being for Kir-Hares. Verse 12, and it shall come to pass when it is seen that Moab is weary in the high place, that he will come to his sanctuary to pray, but he will not prevail. This is the word which the Lord has spoken concerning Moab since that time. But now the Lord has spoken, saying, within 3 years, as the years of a hired man, the glory of Moab will be despised with all that great multitude, and the remnant would be very small and feeble.
All right, without yelling out, I want to give everyone an opportunity to think through this. Where is the promise of a Messiah in this chapter? Don't yell it out. I'm looking for the people who never participate. Where is the promise of a Messiah in this chapter? Write it down somewhere. Log it in your brain. What verse, if you have to pick a verse, where's the promise of a Messiah in this verse?
Verse
in this chapter. Okay, how about somebody who's not said a single word this week or last week? All right, that you have meet last week's criteria 100%. What is it, Ben?
From verse 5, then the throne will be established in steadfast love, and on it will sit in faithfulness to the tent of David, one who judges and seeks justice and is swift to do righteousness.
Okay, and why do you say, what was your first dead giveaway? What were the things that you were looking at that alerted you to that answer?
It's the throne will be established in the tent of David.
Yep. All right. Did anyone see anything else? Why is that exciting? Why do we care about that? Why, in the context of verse 16, of chapter 16?
It's saying that there's going to be a new ruler, and it will be a son of David, and it's coming to Jesus.
Over a Gentile nation.
Over a Gentile nation.
What are the promises?
Refuge.
What else? He's going to be quick to execute justice. Mm-hmm. He will judge and pursue what is right. I think the New King James has slightly different language. Read verse 5 again. Please.
Yeah, it says here in verse 5, in mercy the throne will be established, and one will sit on it in truth, in the tabernacle of David, judging and seeking justice and hastening righteousness.
Okay. Yeah. All right. What other translations are out there? What else do you all have? What's NASB say?
Well, I've got the NET and NASB. Verse 5?
Yeah.
Okay. Then a trustworthy king will be established. He will rule in a reliable manner. This one from David's family. He will be sure to make just decisions and will be experienced in executing justice. That's in that.
Okay. What's the NASB say?
A throne will be established in loving kindness, and a judge will sit on it in faithfulness in the tent of David. Moreover, he will seek justice and be prompt in righteousness.
Okay, I want you to listen to Blake as he outlines just the first sentence in both translations. Just the first sentence, Blake.
A throne will even be established in loving kindness.
Okay. And then the net.
Then a trustworthy king will be established.
Okay, they don't sound anything alike. They don't sound anything alike, do they?
No.
Okay, and this is really helpful. What accounts for the difference?
Translation committees.
What?
Translation committees.
Yes, translation committees. But what accounts for the difference between the two translation committees?
Are they translating from different texts?
No, they're not translating from different texts.
Are they in different time periods?
Nope, they're not in different time periods.
The root word for reigning king, the throne?
Not bad. Not bad at all.
We didn't hear what
he said. Trey says...
Well, was it the root word for throne and reign for king?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The NET Bible, New English Translation, wants to go out of its way to make sure you get it. That you get it. So they take throne, which is clearly in the Hebrew, because your Bible has throne, and your Bible has throne, and everybody's got throne, and they turn it into what?
King.
Because from their perspective,
only
a king sits on the throne. So they don't feel like they're doing any injustice with the text whatsoever.
I will say, spectacular thing about the NET is that they have notes, and it's free online, and they will tell you why they made a decision. And so if you click on the notes here, it says, in Hebrew, it says, and a throne will be established in faithfulness, and he will sit on it in reliability in the tent of David. So they do provide that, but they choose to make it a note as opposed to the actual text.
Yes, because their goal is to help you comprehend correctly. Now, if they get it right all the time, then that's awesome. Right? If they get it right all the time, then that's really helpful. But if you only rely on that one single translation and you don't look at any other translations, then what you're saying is they always get it right. They always get it right, so I don't need to think about it. Now, in this case, I think they got it right.
Well, and also in verse 1, this is really interesting. In the NASB, it says, send the tribute lamb to the ruler of the land. And the word tribute there is inserted. In the NET Bible, it says, send rams as a tribute to the ruler of the land. It's so different. And I, without, the process that I use, would say tribute lamb sounds very messianic. Mm-hmm. I would just go straight there. But anyways.
Yeah, Pastor Sean, when I was looking at this, when you asked us to see where the Messiah was there, I went to verse 1 first,
yeah.
Looking back there.
Yeah, you too.
But I only have the ESV and it says send the lamb. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I was thinking, Messiah. When I looked at verse 5, though, there's better there. But I think 1 supports 5 in terms of the message of peace and all.
Depending upon how we understand lamb, right?
Yeah.
If the context of sending the lamb is to pacify you, then it's not messianic at all. I'm making a peace offering.
Yeah.
Right? This is what Jacob did when he was going to meet his estranged brother Esau.
Yeah.
And he kept dividing up into 3 things, and he sent stuff ahead of time. And finally, they link up with Esau's like, I got plenty, okay? Like, I don't need your money, all right? I've got my own. So that's why the NET Bible is inserting the word tribute there.
That's the NASB that's inserting tribute.
But you said the NET. Read verse 1 in the NET Bible.
Send rams as tribute.
Okay, so as tribute,
yeah.
Either way. Tribute's not in the text.
Yeah.
Why are they putting the word tribute in there?
Because in 2 Kings chapter 3, verse 4, it says that the Moabites regularly paid the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and the wool of 100,000 rams. So it's like a payment for...
Right, so why did the NASB Translation Committee and the NET Bible Translation Committee decide to put the word tribute in there? Why?
It's a gift.
To help, to help you understand.
Yeah, they're not sure you, the reader, are going to understand that this is a payment of tribute. What's tribute?
Yeah.
It's well, no, it's a payment for peace. I'm giving you this in exchange for peace or security or to leave me alone.
Right. So, like, I run the local gang on Main Street, and you give me tribute to make sure that nobody breaks into your thing, and that's. So it's not quite a gift.
It's like a treaty.
Yes, it's a payment associated with an agreement. Mm-hmm. What does the King James say, Chris? On verse number 1.
Send ye the lamb.
That's right. Now, the beauty of that is, the King James translation is known for its literalness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even if you can't figure it out, that's your problem. It works hard at just making sure that it gives you the most reputable English translation at that time of the Hebrew text that they had available to them. And they're not inserting additional words there. That's why it's just very literal right there. And then the NASB chooses to add something. Mm-hmm. The NET Bible chooses to add something there. The difference between the NASB and the NET Bible... And the NASB, what does the tribute look like? Is it italicized?
That's the what I was just about to say. It's italicized.
Jeez, come on.
I really
nobody believes that.
That's the spirit working right there.
Go ahead, Jack. I can't take it anymore. I saw that deep breath that you had from Blake. Yeah.
No, the Jewish Bible has lambs plural.
Yep.
And it says send lambs to the ruler of the land.
But they have identifiers that help the reader understand this is not in the text.
That's right. And you, the reader of an English Bible, must learn your translation.
Yeah. Yeah. Even New King James has italicized every once in a while because it just, I don't want to say it's around, it's Genesis. It actually says, come on, what's his name? Jacob and Esau, and he's like, give me that red, is what it literally says. But like, they have to add stews. It just absolutely doesn't make any sense.
Right.
You don't, so.
Yeah, so you need to learn, why does my Bible do the things that it does? And your King James Bible does it rarely, but it is in there and italicized. And it lets you know that this is not part of the original Hebrew or the original Greek. Now, where is the Davidic covenant? Because, and don't blurt it out, this is something that everyone in the room should know. Where is the... Did he whisper it to you? Right, so this is your chance to see, be impressed by your husband.
We're equally yoked here, okay?
I love it.
Yeah, we'll see how yoked you are when she's giving birth to that child. And you're just standing there laughing. You won't be very yoked then.
You're
going to
be clapping.
Yeah. Go, girl, go, girl. You can do it, you can do it, yeah. Okay. Okay. Hey, all right, so somebody on this row right here, because you guys are not done any talking over here. Nate, my friend, that is so talkative, we have to tell him to shut up. who knows where the Davidic covenant is? Y'all are killing me.
1 Samuel 16. Is it?
Not bad. Not bad. You're in the right set of books, so that's not bad. 2 Samuel 7. Let's go there. 2 Samuel 7. You've got to commit this to memory.
I'm barely.
Nicely done. Okay, we've got to commit this to memory. This is a big, big deal. Okay? Okay, there's only a handful of covenants that are this important. This is one of them. Okay, Blake, who is the prophet that brings this covenant to David? Who is the prophet who brings this covenant to David?
It's a great question. I'm on the way there.
No. I'm not looking for you to look to find. I want you to tell me. Okay?
What's the first letter of the
name? Seriously, we got to go there?
Oh,
you want to phone a friend?
Samuel. No.
Who said Samuel?
Oh, it's Nathan. Hey, look. I'm a researcher. I don't know.
Oh, now he's a researcher. He's a researcher.
He just hasn't researched that yet.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So where do we want to start reading? Why don't we start with verse number 3, Blake?
Yeah. 2 Samuel 7:3. Nathan said to the king.
Who is it?
Nathan?
Yeah.
Nathan said to the king, "Go do all that is in your mind, for the Lord is with you." All
right, stop.
Mind's his heart.
Okay, are y'all going to really mince words between heart and mind at this point? Because from a Jewish perspective, there is no distinction between the two. It is one in their minds. What?
Sorry, I caught it.
What does David want to do? Sam back there, as in Mrs. Adams. What does David want to do? Can you remember what David wants to do? I don't mean to put you on the spot. What's he want to do for God? He says, I live in a house. And you're still in that tent. And what's he want to do? I want to build you a house, right? And so what's Nathan say?
Do it.
No, what's he say right now? In this verse, what's he say? He says, do it. Nathan doesn't check with God. He's just like, great idea. I love the idea. Can't wait to spend the first preaching service in the new house of God. All right? All right, now pick it up, Blake.
But in the same night, the word of the Lord came to Nathan, saying, verse 5, go and say to my servant David, thus says the Lord, are you the one who should build me a house to dwell in? For I have not dwelt in a house since the day I brought up the sons of Israel from Egypt, even to this day. But I have been moving about in a tent, even in a tabernacle. Verse 7. Wherever I have gone with all the sons of Israel, did I speak a word with one of the tribes of Israel, which I commanded to my shepherd, my people Israel, saying, why have you not built me a house of cedar? Verse 8. Now therefore, thus you shall say to my servant David, thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the pasture, from following sheep, to be the ruler over my people Israel. Verse 9. I have been with you wherever you have gone, and have cut off all your enemies from before you. And I will make you a great name, like the names of the great men who are on the earth.
Verse 10, I will also appoint a place for my people Israel, and I will plant them, that they may live in their own place and not to be disturbed again, nor will the wicked afflict them any more as formerly, even from the day that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel. And I will give you rest from all your enemies. The Lord also declares to you that the Lord will make a house for you. Verse 12. When your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your descendant after you, who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom. Verse 13. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Verse 14. I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the son of men. But my loving kindness shall not depart from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed before you. Your house and your kingdom shall endure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever, in accordance with all these words and all this vision. So Nathan spoke today.
All right, perfect. Now hold that place and turn to Matthew 1:1. Turn that and hold to Matthew 1:1. It's in the New Testament, believe.
I lost my places.
Yeah, he's turning back to Genesis, so that's why I let him load up in the New Testament.
There's a table of contents.
Yes, there is a table of contents.
Where's that? I got to file something with HR.
Yes, you do. Yeah, you absolutely do. All right, read 1:1 for us, please.
The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham.
All right, so here's your question tonight for someone who hasn't talked. Why are those two names there? Of all the names, why are those two names there? Someone who doesn't talk, answer that question.
Because of the covenants that he's made with both those men.
Did you hear that? That was your husband. Pinch yourself right now to make sure this is not a dream. You're exactly right. Perfect. That's exactly correct. This is the immediate notification to us that Jesus is going to be the fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant, that Jesus is going to be the fulfillment of the Davidic covenant. And that's why you, in this room, as a student of the Bible, must know Genesis 12, Genesis 15, Genesis 17, Abrahamic covenant. 2 Samuel 7, Davidic covenant. Promises in this one, promises in this one. And Jesus says, I got them all. I am the fulfillment of both of them. Now, where do we see, we got 4 minutes left before Juana dismisses. Where do we see the dualistic nature in chapter 7? The dualistic nature in chapter 7. The dualism in chapter 7. Because you should be able to see Jesus all over 7. Right, so in chapter 7, where do you see the dualistic fulfillments? What words as he was reading, you're tracking, you get to what verse and you're like, what is this all about?
Verse 12 on.
Okay, good. Yep. Look at 14 in particular. Read 14, Nate.
I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commit iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men, with the stripes of the children of men.
Okay, that's really problematic.
Yeah.
Like, what is that doing in there? That shouldn't be in there. Until you understand what?
Solomon.
Exactly. Until you understand Solomon. And when you recognize that when Nathan issues this prophecy, that he has two men in mind. He's got the immediate son of David in mind, who's going to build a house for Yahweh. And he's got Jesus in mind, who's going to build a house for Yahweh.
And I think what's amazing about this is the Jews had to realize that this was a dual fulfillment also. Because once Solomon dies...
You mean the saved Jews?
What do you mean? What's your...
Well, you said the Jews, so do you... Because you said they had to realize, but they don't.
Oh, well, I'm saying the Jews of that time had to have known that once Solomon dies, you're like, okay, this is obviously a descendant of David in the future.
That's right, yeah. Which means they're looking for a Messiah who's going to reestablish the throne of David in Rome, against the Romans, And Jesus fails to do that.
Yeah, and that's why I think it's important for us to recognize dual fulfillment, because the Jews of that time would have been forced to recognize dual fulfillment, or else their hopes would have been destroyed.
Of course. Because the unique Hebraic transitions here. He's David. I want to build a house for you. No way. I mean, the Lord kind of rips Nathan apart. Did I mention I needed a house? Was I complaining about living in a tent?
Yeah.
Have I not been doing this fine without it? Did you hear me mumbling about not having a house? And then he says, Yahweh himself will make a house for you. David wants to build a house for Yahweh, and Yahweh is going to build a house for David. Some of your translations might have dynasty.
Yes, royal dynasty.
Right. But it's the same Hebraic word. It's the same Hebrew word. And you have to understand it in its context. Okay? And then he says, and when your time comes and you rest with your fathers, I will raise up for you your descendant who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name.
Yeah.
So I'm going to build a house for you. Your son's going to build a house for me. Obviously talking about Solomon. Obviously talking about the temple. And then he goes on to say, and this one's going to come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever.
That's and really cool.
Yes, because Solomon doesn't make it forever.
Yeah.
Right. Go ahead, Sean.
I've also heard in this where there's a model. The tabernacle is moving with the people, and the whole and the word of God is within that tabernacle, and God's like, hey, I'm with them. I'm wherever they went, I went. But I don't need to be in one place this time.
Locked down geographically.
And then later on in the New Testament, it's clear that we're the tabernacle.
That's
we're
right.
Moving with the people.
Yep. Right. But what's unique, Sean, is that in a little bit of time, Solomon will say, will you come here? And God, and Yahweh says, yep,
yeah.
I'll do it.
Yeah.
I'll do it. If you ask me, I'll do it.
That's cool.
I want to be with my people, and I'll do it. Go
real
to
real fast. You know, this is why whenever you look at dispensationalism, they say there has to be a third temple. And it doesn't make any sense, because now you're restricting God back down to a temple again.
Sean hasn't made his mind up on that yet.
Oh, well, that's the reason right. why you should change your mind, I guess.
I'm just joking. I just love how everything's going dandy, and then all of a sudden you throw a grenade in at the room.
Well, that's,
yes, it is. That's what time. Time does. All right, we're dismissed. Bye. Come back next week, please.